You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Hello, everybody. Welcome once again to the Parish Council. This is the official podcast from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw, and he invented medicinal compound. He's Terence DeCorm. Good morning.
Hello, Magnus Shaw. How the devil are you with your reference to the scaffold Christmas hit there of 1968?
Oh, well, all the better for getting the statistics on it from you, sir. That's, Christmas number one, was it?
Oh, now you've got me. I imagine it probably was. Yeah, right. It's sort of thing that would have, novelty hit that probably would have made number one in 1968.
I can remember my mum singing it to me as a kid, and that would make me about three, so yeah, it could well be.
I think it probably was. I think 1969, I think, would have been two little boys with Roll.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I think probably 68, yeah, probably was.
Christmas number one. There you go. Mm. Anyway, are you well?
I'm very, very well. I'm ready, prepared for all activities. I've got my glass of Robinson's orange barley water by my side.
Oh, smashing. Yeah. You don't ever score the lemon barley water, the drink of Wimbledon champions?
I haven't tried it. Is it good?
Oh, they're very good, yes. I think you've done it the wrong way around. I'd always thought that the lemon was the gateway drink for the barley water abuser.
I think I just picked up the orange and then have run with it ever since, because I gave up coffee about 6 months ago.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I've looked for a substitute ever since, and this is filling the void.
Tried the Polish drinking spirit. I believe that's quite refreshing.
I haven't tried that nor car screen wash nor meth. I'm sticking to the orange barley water for the moment.
A scrumpy with a dash of Dettol is always good.
See, it's a great difficulty for me, Magnus Shaw, because I don't drink alcohol.
No.
I've not really liked tea since I was a child, and I don't drink coffee, and I don't drink fizzy drinks. I mean, I'm very limited when it comes to liquid refreshment.
Yeah, perhaps as of just a permanent intravenous drip.
Certainly would help.
It would, absolutely. Well, I'm glad you're fully equipped with your barley water, because we have a lot to get through. Well, it's been quite an interesting week, hasn't it? And I think that an enormous amount of media coverage for the curly-haired, flared jeans and the corduroy jacket wearer, Mr. Jeremy Clarkson, has managed to stir up something of a firestorm. For those who've been visiting Venus or something for the last few days, what he's managed to do is on strike day, they fetched him up on the One show on BBC One, where he, it depends which version of the story you follow here. Well, what he's quoted as saying is that he wished that all striking public sector workers would be taken outside and shot in front of their families. Now, he did say this, and this created quite a storm, and many sort of po-faced unionists were then dragged into various BBC studios to condemn what he'd said. But I have since seen the clip of the whole thing that he said, and it puts it in, throws it into some relief, I have to say the least. It makes quite some difference. But what's your take on it?
Well, yes, Clarkson, the Punchinello of Chipping Norton. The mountebank and clown for Daily Mail readers.
Yes.
I think it's a little coincidence that these Clarkson controversies inevitably occur during Advent, or as shops prefer to call it, the run-up to Christmas, when this rather buffoon of a fellow has yet another DVD.
Yeah, isn't that strange? Imagine those controversies coinciding with a DVD release. Who would have thought that?
Exactly. Now, in my view, his appetite for wearing jeans at his age is more of a trauma than what he actually says on TV.
Especially as he irons creases into the front of them. That's the
appalling, isn't it? I mean, he's actually been blamed for the decline in sales of Levi's, as he's unaccountably made the wearing of jeans a sort of must for the desperate men of Middle England as they queue for the Tesco car wash, weeping quietly as they remember their dreams. But anyway, I think Clarkson is not, it would seem, a man given to weighing up arguments before expressing or even blurting out his opinion.
No.
But I've got little doubt in this current compliance-obsessed world at the BBC that all parties knew the broad outline of what he was going to say before he said it.
I would have thought that. I would guess that he lulled them into something of a false sense of security. I can't imagine that was, you know, scripted and presented for clearance before the show, but I can quite believe that he said, look, if you're going to ask me about the strikers, I'll give you something to really get your teeth into. And the producer said, yeah, you know, do your worst, Jeremy. And then that's what he did. But anyway, do carry on. Yeah.
No, I think you're right, because before you draw breath on a programme like The One Show, young ladies with clipboards and headsets will have checked and double-checked the comments he was going to make about the public sector strike. And I think any broadcaster who books clerks and knows what they're going to get.
Well, this is the point, yes. I mean, we fall for it every time, don't we?
We do.
Righteous indignation because Jeremy Clarkson said something stupid. And, that he is stupid comments for hire, isn't he? Yeah,
he is. He's the quickster of the country set.
I only wish he was, more witty with it, really. I mean, outrageous comments I can, live with. I endear me to a person, provided they are quite original and sharp and, witty. And his are often very sort of flat and lumpy and crass, aren't they? That's my only complaint, is they're not terribly funny. But,
well, that's right. I mean, when I refer to him being the spokesman for the country set, I mean, it's that sort of country set, like I talked about earlier, the sort of the chap, in his Tesco jumper.
Yeah,
It's the country set who spend the week in Holland Park and then drive out to the Cotswolds on a Friday afternoon, bringing the A40 to a standstill. he says, with bitter experience. Yes. I think that the history of the things Clarkson has said shows us that the shoot the strikers comment is nothing new. I don't know if you remember in February 2009. Again, probably had a book then, it wouldn't have been for the Christmas DVD. He called Gordon Brown a one-eyed Scottish idiot, and that caused all sorts of controversy.
Yeah, exactly. Not particularly incisive or clever, that's my only complaint. The fact that it's in inverted commas shocking, I don't have a problem with that. Peter Cook was shocking, but he was also, incredibly funny and sharp and insightful, which Clarkson's just very lumpen, I think. But anyway, here's the thing with what he actually said.
Right.
It says something about context. I have no axe to grind for Jeremy Clarkson. He represents many of the things which I find desperately tiresome. But, in the interest of fairness, what he actually said was, when asked about the public sector strikers, he said, well, this is the BBC, so I have to give a balanced viewpoint. So, on the one hand, I adore them, love them, and fully support them. On the other hand, I think they should be taken out and shot in front of their families. So he was actually making a point about the ludicrous insistence on balance on BBC programmes. But that preamble about him loving the strikers was completely erased from the reporting. What he was really doing is making two equally stupid comments to say that's what balance brings you, which is, actually quite liberal for Jeremy Clarkson to make that point. He made it in such a way that they were able to lift the second part of his comments out and make it look like he was a rampant fascist. So on this one, I think, Clarkson was actually making a different point from the one that's been reported, but he did it in such a way that shock would ensue no matter what. So.
Yeah, absolutely, and I mean it was astonishing for me the following day to be listening to phone-ins, particularly Nikki Campbell's phone-in on 5 Live at 9 o'clock, where there was a representative. Sheila Fogarty and Victoria Derbyshire later on the day in 5 Live equally had union representatives.
Yes, and really saying, Stephen Nolan last night as well.
Really, my God, it's still running. Really taking it ridiculously seriously and saying, what an example to our young folk, and he should be prosecuted, and so on. Oh God, get really. If it was a joke, it wasn't a very funny one, but he was just being silly, like people are sometimes. People sometimes are silly.
Yeah.
He didn't actually mean
no.
He wanted strikers to be taken outside and shot.
Of course not. And he is rent-a-gob. If the BBC wished to avoid Clarkson gates every 6 months, then don't hire him. Don't put him
don't
on things.
Him.
You know, it's you can't have your cake and eat it. You know, you can't dip your toe in the water of shock jockery and then run away screaming when it's, you know, when your toe is bitten. You know, make up your flipping mind, really.
And he loves these sort of moments as well. I mean, it's only in September this year that he used his column in Britain's much-loved daily, The Sun, to call for the abolition of the Welsh language. Well, you know, you can almost hear him giggling to himself as he writes that, can't you? You know that that's going to, you know, raise the roof in the Rondas, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I've never met Clarkson, and I don't know anybody who has, but I wouldn't be at all surprised to have it reported to me that he's actually quite an affable, liberal, cheery fella who's making a handsome living out of almost sending up right-wing bigotry, really. I mean, you could read a lot of irony into his behaviour, to be perfectly honest. So,
the self-appointed denim-clad, let's see, jester.
Exactly.
Who he knows exactly what he's doing, and the reaction and the publicity bring him much joy and increase sales for his books and DVDs. And I think that's, you know, the whole point.
Yes, of course it is. And with several dozen, if not more, high-profile people behaving in a way that, to my mind, is extraordinarily offensive and dangerous to the country, I think we would do ourselves a favour and be not to be distracted from them by the antics of Mr. Clarkson. But there you go. I think no harm done, personally.
No harm done is the summary.
Absolutely, absolutely. So whilst we're waxing lyrical about the BBC, we give the BBC a tough ride on these podcasts, but I think only in the same way that you give your long-term partner a rough ride about their faults and foibles, because we're both massive consumers of the BBC and enjoy much of their output. But as we do fund them, along with the rest of the country, I think we're entitled to point the finger and sneer a little.
Oh, but I would say I love the BBC.
Yes,
I'd be lost without it.
Absolutely,
so, yeah.
Absolutely. But yeah, it is a public...
Given that caveat, off you go.
Yeah, well, yes, indeed, yes. It is a publicly funded body, so really it is ours to toy with, isn't it, really? So that's why we like to
let it be our plaything.
Pick it apart. Yes, exactly. And opportunities have risen this week for me to do just that. And it doesn't come from Mr. Clarkson. It comes from a leaked memo. If the one thing the BBC... I beg your pardon, I was banging my head against the microphone. If there's one thing...
I was worried for your welfare for a moment there.
Yeah, see,
it sounded like an oil... drum had landed on your head.
Yeah, no, okay, collapsed over the microphone in a drink of stupor. No, I just
thought I was going to have to film for an hour.
Well, that wouldn't be a problem, would it?
No.
And thereby lies our podcast.
Exactly.
No, I was just reaching for this memo, actually, and clunked the microphone rather than professional.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so this is a leaked memo. Now, one thing the BBC is terribly guilty of is appalling management speak, isn't it? They internally, they are mired in this modern management strategic whatnots. And this is just a prime example that has been leaked this week. Let me read this to you then. So the memo is headed Bite Size Rebuild and Next Gen. And
I like it already.
Yes, right. Indeed. Sorry, yeah. And it rolls on. This project takes the learnings from recent years around Wildlife Finder and food and applies these to Bite Size, with the ambition that Bite Size contributes a core domain model, that's in inverted commas, to K&L. The, inverted commas again, pan-UK curricular, close inverted commas, domain model. Bite Size is an anchor tenant, that's again inverted commas, of the new K&L platform, and in this work receives a new branding facelift. In order to make sure we are getting the synergies between inverted commas knowledge and inverted commas learning right, we will likely focus initially on the cross-linking opportunities between Bite Size, health, and history. There endeth the memo.
Do you know, if you read that to me another 15 or 30 times,
sure,
I still don't think I would have absorbed anything other than the word cross-linking, which...
Yeah, Bite Size is in there a lot as well. We don't.
Bite Size is there a lot, isn't
there? We have no... We have no idea what bite size may consist of, but
do you know the context of this? I mean, does it?
Yeah, I do. I'm just musing. I think it'd be unfair to name the author of the ammo, but
was it actually a BBC person or one of their highly paid contracted advisors?
Well, that's hard to say, but I think he is a staffer at the BBC.
Oh my God!
I have his job title.
Okay.
And I'll have his job if I have my way. I have his job title, Editorial Lead, Knowledge and Learning. That's so anybody who has intimate knowledge of the BBC will be able to put a name to that. But he's Editorial Lead, Knowledge and Learning. Yeah.
That is just ridiculous. And again, just shows what happens. I don't think it's unique to the BBC. I think this can happen in any major organisation or company or corporation where in-speak and jargon become the norm. And that's clearly happened to this man. You said it's a man.
It is a man. Yeah.
My giddy aunt. For heaven's sake. I think any internal memo that, if it were read by someone who doesn't work for the organisation and they couldn't make sense of it, is a very poor memo indeed. Because as soon as you start heading down that route of K's and L's and bite sizes and cross linkings, it's, in the end, it's just so much piffle, isn't
it? Really? K&L Knowledge and Learning, I'm just suddenly dawned on.
I only realised when you gave me his job title, that's what K&L was.
Absolute nonsense. And unforgivable, really, to say that, you know, the amount of money some of the management structure in the BBC attracts, or some of the salaries that those people attract, and B, these people are working in a communications business, probably the communications business in the UK, and yet they cannot communicate in a straightforward and rational way. That's the worry.
Amazing. I tell you what, Magnus Shaw, I saw on the running order today BBC memo, and I had no idea what it was until you just revealed that to us now.
That's true.
But it works actually really well because I can contrast your 2011 memo.
Yeah.
I thought, it just reminded me of a memo I had seen a couple of years ago from the BBC archives, which is, in my view, just absolutely wonderful.
Okay.
A memo from the 31st of March, 1938.
Wow, okay,
An internal memo from the BBC Home Service, which for younger listeners was the name that Radio 4 had in a different generation.
Yes.
And in 1938, there was a program called The World Goes By, and it was presented by Freddie Griswood, who was one of those marvellous old BBC fellows with a fantastic voice, a bit like Brian Johnson.
You know how Harry Enfield used to love to spoof the old BBC, didn't he?
Yeah.
And everything you've said so far, if you'd said, this is from Harry Enfield's BBC sketch, I would believe you. The World Goes By just sounds like a sort of a tilt at that old style BBC, but that is the actual old style BBC.
Oh, with Freddie Griswood.
Absolutely
genuine. Frederick Henry Griswood. He had an entire life was spent with the BBC. He was there from 1929, I'm not even sure he was certainly still there in the 60s.
Wow. 1929, though, the transmitters could barely have been switched on in 1929, surely.
Well, it's interesting, actually, before I tell you about the memo, that Freddie Griswood, he was actually the commentator for the first ever BBC Live Outside broadcast.
Okay.
And this was in 1937.
Yeah.
And it's estimated that there were less than 1,000 television sets in homes throughout the country.
So his
audience would have been so tiny.
Yes.
But despite this, this first live outside broadcast, it was the coronation in 1937.
Yeah.
And they'd actually arranged, the BBC sent a message to the King asking him to give a special wave for the camera. And this was the very start, perhaps, of where we have the monarchy now with
the wave.
You know, with the wave.
Oh, really? Yes, yeah. And only the royals wave like that, don't they? I'm doing it now, which comes across fantastically.
I'm doing it too.
Yeah. Only the royals wave like that, don't they? It's sort of a chopping motion, isn't it? With sort of the
Yes.
Couple of the fingers fold, slightly folded, yeah.
Yes, but so chopping outwards.
Yes, that's right.
Outwards,
yes. Yeah. Certainly nobody else waves in quite that way. No.
Though we've gone off a tangent a little, I would say that Freddie Grimes, we're talking about that outside broadcasting, he said that when the royal carriage appeared coming towards them, and he was ready to commentate on the royal wave, all the equipment failed. But the engineer in charge, wearing one of those brown overalls, gave it a kick, and it all came to life again. So the day was won. Freddie also commentated on the first televised broadcast of tennis at Wimbledon in the 30s, also in 37.
When the men would have been in long trousers.
Sure, they would have been, and quite rightly so.
I would just say, and then we'll go back to the memo. I would just say that the BBC started to lose its way when it stopped insisting that its technical and engineering staff wore brown work coats. That should have been there
in those days.
Yeah, it should have continued, definitely.
I've certainly been in Television Centre. Where the chaps wearing the brown, I call them overalls, but they're more like coats, aren't they?
From they wore in the old hardware stores.
Very, very, very similar. Yes, it is a shame that those days have gone. They're probably all in fleeces and T-shirts now. And almost inevitably with clipboards. The world goes by 31st of March 1938. Mr. Pringle sent this letter. It was a memo to Mr. Pringle from the producer, who's called, his initials are UMB, because it's obviously a secretary has typed this memo.
What could his Christian name have been, beginning with a U, I wonder?
Ulysses?
Yes, exactly.
That's all I can think of. So this memo to Mr. Pringle from the producer of The World Goes By, 31st March 1938, verbatim. There's no dear sir or anything like that. She says, Mr. Pringle, could a supply of brandy be kept available for the speakers in this programme in case of need? Last night, one of the speakers was violently ill with indigestion before and during the broadcast, while another completely lost her nerve and nearly broke down. In brackets, my compere, Mr. Griswood, thought at one point in the transmission that she would actually faint. Not only were the speakers themselves affected, but their obvious distress was communicated to the other people in the studio and so affected the entire broadcast.
This was like a contagion there, sir.
Yes. The seriousness of such incidents, brackets, which are by no means exceptional, close brackets, could, I feel, be minimised if brandy was available for offering when the need became sufficiently grave.
Of course.
And that's to JP from UMB and initialled by the very same.
Oh, priceless.
On the 31st of March 1938, war brewing over the horizon in Europe.
there's so many things you can read into that. But first of all, the fact that the presenters were called speakers. You would never refer.
The guests were called speakers. The man presenting was compere. My compere, Mr. Bryant.
Yeah, compares and speakers.
He was the compere. And it even has the accent over the E in compere.
Ken Bruce would be presenter and his guest would be a guest.
Speakers.
Wouldn't it? So it would be a speaker. How marvellous. And the idea that one of them had rank indigestion, which. Undoubtedly triggered by a right royal lunch he'd had on the Strand previously, and then the lady speaker had a fit of the vapors.
Exactly.
Yes, it's just
nearly broke down.
It froze in front of the mic and nearly fainted. That's just remarkable. And the idea that her distress then spread like wildfire around the studio. until everybody was just sort of gibbering and shaking. And
nobody breathe. We've got an attack of nerves. So there's nobody breathe.
Only Freddy there to try and wrest the thing from the jaws of defeat, and no brandy to hand.
Exactly.
They would have all been smoking like chimneys, wouldn't they, as well?
I'm sure they would.
Yeah. There's really strong non-filter cigarettes, but that was insufficient. It called for brandy, so how fabulous. It just everything about that speaks of almost a time that is so distant, it's like another planet, isn't it?
It really is, isn't it? You're absolutely right. Just 70 years ago, just over 70 years ago, but it could be a different planet, a different universe. We've moved on so far.
I love hearing stories of the early days of the BBC, because long before commercial broadcasting. So this was the birth of British broadcasting, and one that always springs to mind. We now have a nation rammed full of people who would wish to work for the BBC. Mm. Only knows why. It wouldn't be for job security or fortune, but nevertheless, if you were to ask a series of newly graduated youngsters, which organisations they'd like to work for, the BBC would be high up there. But it's obviously very hard to get into. They're cutting numbers, the interview processes are fairly rigorous, etc., etc. But there's a story about how Ned Sherrin, the late Ned Sherrin, ended up working at the BBC. And he was walking up the Strand, and he bumped into a guy he'd been up at Oxford with, I think, if not at his public school. But anyway, somebody he'd been educated with. And he said, "Ned, what are you doing with yourself?" And he said he'd been working for a law firm, perhaps, or maybe in the city, perhaps. I can't remember, but, somewhere where a gentleman would be employed. But he was, he was a little bored and was looking for something else. And he said, "Well, my dear fellow, why don't you come and work at the BBC? You could head a department." And 3 days later, that's what he did.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, as you rightly said, it's probably far from unique.
Yeah.
In the 30s and 40s, one probably jolly well did stroll along the Strand and bump into an old pal, and the next day, you'd be leading a division of the BBC.
Yes, exactly so. And then they stayed at the BBC till the day he died from there. But it was just a matter of running into the right old school friend to get yourself your own department at the BBC.
And I think particularly just after the Second World War, when people, chaps particularly, came back from fighting over in Europe. And I think that seemed to be something of the old boys network then, that one would meet a chap that one had been sharing the trenches with or whatever, and that would be a way in.
So long fondly remembered the days at the BBC, which, completely different, so different now, that we get memos like the one I read.
Yes.
Are commonplace. Yeah. That's how it's changed. So, great stuff. Now, I know you are often to be found pursuing the more obscure avenues of the internet in your spare time.
I see, yes.
But clearly you also visit those mainstream sites like TripAdvisor, because you sent me we call them emails now, don't we? But let's call it a memo, right, to keep the to keep the
I put my initials at the bottom of it.
Yes. Well, actually, we both do that, don't we?
We do, actually, don't we? We both put our initials at the bottom of emails, just like Freddie Griswold's producer at the BBC.
We must be harking back without knowing it to that golden age of memos. Anyway, you sent me an electronic memo earlier in the week, and
electronic memo,
just despairing at the demands on your time and energies by TripAdvisor. So what upset you?
Well, it was brought into focus. My own trauma was brought into focus by a piece in the Daily Telegraph a week or so ago, where they reported on the situation at TripAdvisor, where dozens and dozens of customers are using, according to the Telegraph, the TripAdvisor's increasing power to try and get free upgrades or refunds, despite there being nothing wrong with their accommodation. What they do is people turn up and book into a hotel, and they anticipate or demand a 50% discount when they check in to say, well, you know, if you give me a discount, I won't give you a one-star review on TripAdvisor.
Right. Right, okay.
And if this compensation, if you like, or, you know, this extortion attempt doesn't work, then they sometimes put up these false reports on things like food poisoning.
This is blackmail by any other name, isn't it?
It really is, yes. In fact, one hotelier in this piece says, I'm fed up of blackmail by guests either asking for upgrades or promising to put a good report on TripAdvisor. Yeah. But people saying that they'll complain if that, you know, if they don't get the money and they'll put a bad review on. So I refer to it as the tyranny of TripAdvisor.
Mm.
Now, why I say this brought this into focus for me is because I don't know about you, but I'm finding more and more and more as days go by that I'm constantly being got at to score things, to rate things. Now, I'll just give you a couple of examples.
Yeah.
I just think it's taking over life.
Yeah.
In September, I stayed in a Swish Hotel on the Sandbanks Peninsula. You may remember I talked about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, despite not booking the hotel myself, they've somehow secured my email address and have emailed me in October and November. I'll be expecting another one this month.
Yes.
Urging me to give them feedback on what they call my experience with them.
Right. Okay.
Now, then we add to that last month my car went in for its annual MOT check at a local garage.
Mm-hmm.
And in the post the next day, Magnus, so they obviously have these prepared,
yes,
and you know, just churn them out, a form arrived for me to complete to rate the level of service I received.
Wow. A paper form?
A paper form arrived through the post, first-class stamp.
Wow.
Yes. Then a week later, back to the same garage because the car was back in there for its annual service.
Right.
I didn't have time to do the two together the previous week.
Okay.
And lo and behold, next day, another copy of the Your Experience form and another request for a response.
Yeah.
But what made me finally bring it to your attention was that I visited a high street retailer during the week. And at the counter, I've never come across this before, at the counter I was invited to push buttons on a pad.
Really?
And on that I could record a range of answers from strongly satisfied to strongly dissatisfied.
This is in a retail outlet?
Yes, yeah? In a retail store, just in a normal shop.
Agree.
And it just made me think, where will it all end? You know, rate my postman. mark my dentist out of 10. ratings for my McDonald's takeaway hot chocolate. You know, where will we finish all this demand for marking and scoring it?
I don't know, and I'm not sure where it's going because I'm not sure what that data is then used for. And obviously, it's no scientific basis to it anyway, so it's not true market research in any sense of the term. And certainly, you know, companies that are doing it for themselves, like your local garage, what are they going to do with those bundles of paper? I can't begin to imagine. If they wish to improve their service, then they just need to have a look around them, see what they could do a bit better. I'm not sure how they would collate or draw any conclusion from the bundles of paper that they get back. And likewise, review websites. Used to imagine that TripAdvisor was very useful. I go abroad a fair bit, and it used to pop into my head, I know, well, before I book this hotel, which seems to be extraordinarily good value, let me have a look and see if there's a very good reason for it being so so cheap. You know, cockroaches in the rooms, typhoid in the swimming pool sort of thing. But I very quickly came to the conclusion that it was absolutely pointless, simply because when you got to the review of the hotel, say there were 12 reviews, maybe 5 would say it was an absolutely remarkable experience, superb value, fantastic service, great food, clean bed linen, wonderful pool. And then the remaining 7 would say absolutely dire, 1 star, children died, you know, wild dogs barking outside the room, Mad Axe men in the corridor, and the thing burnt down. And so you've got half an hour. You've got 50% of people say they would rather remove a limb than return, and 50% of people saying that they wish they could move in there. So what does that tell you? It doesn't tell you anything at all. It tells you absolutely nothing at all. You don't know who's posted the positive ones, who posted the negative, what their expectations were, how much they paid, how much they expected to pay, where they'd been before, how many times that year they've been on holiday. You don't know any of that. All you know is an usually appallingly spelt set of comments about a hotel totally split between the two groups. So it takes us nowhere. I don't understand it. And I wish somebody would explain to what end this data is being gathered.
Curious you mention the astonishingly positive reviews, because in researching for this item, it took me back to a report also in the Telegraph, only from a couple of months ago, September 2011, mm-hmm. About a hotel in Worcestershire, in the lovely Evesham area. Uh-huh. Now, that hotel has been red flagged, as they call it, by TripAdvisor, because officials from TripAdvisor believe that the hotel management had in fact posted this glowing review.
Yes.
In breach of its rules, and they've placed a warning notice, and on its site, on its page about this hotel. Now you might think, that's a sort of typical thing to do, but the owner of this particular hotel has said that it's been an absolute catastrophe since they were red flagged in this way, because they were ranked number one in the area, and she's quoted as saying bookings dried up almost overnight.
Oh, okay,
so. You know, indeed, the business, could even close.
Yeah, there is a peril built into this sort of free-for-all comment stuff, isn't there, really? What we always say, quite often the hotels we pick to stay at abroad are more than adequate for us. We have really modest expectations if we're not paying very much. All we requires some basic hygiene, a smile at the reception desk, and a bed that is clean and sleepable in. And anything above and beyond that is a bonus if we haven't paid very much, as far as I'm concerned. But some of the negative reviews of the places we've stayed just are clearly expecting too much from the kind of hotel they're going to stay in. And often it says that the staff are rude and surly and ignorant and everything. But my experience, especially in continental Europe, is that the attitude of the people serving you in hotels is much, much better than it is in this country. The service is pretty good consistently across Europe and indeed in America. And so it makes me wonder what these reviewers have actually done to extract a surly and begrudging attitude out of these rather lovely people.
Well, I've got a perfect example of what you're just saying, because I then went on to look at the actual rating for this hotel that I'm talking about in Evesham, and it's dropped actually from number one to number eight in Evesham since September. The message from TripAdvisor is still there, saying, the red flag, mm-hmm. as we say. But within 1 week in November, indeed within 5 days of each other, these two reviews, I'll just read a couple of sentences from each, were placed on TripAdvisor. In fact, they're the last two reviews that are showing. The first one says, "Great stay. After reading all the reviews, we were dreading our stay, but what a lovely surprise. Our room was clean, warm and peaceful, and the view were wonderful." Talking about your English. And amazingly, they've managed to spell the four-letter word view incorrectly. "The staff were friendly and most helpful. We had a fantastic breakfast. Thank you to Brian, the chef."
Right. Thanks, Brian. Yeah.
5 days later... Mm. "Don't stay here.
Quite so.
Book this hotel for my girlfriend's birthday. Yeah. When we arrived, the room I had booked was double booked. Our alternative wasn't a good room, a bit grubby, and the outdoor area was dirty and a store place for random junk. The hot water was off, and we had to ask for it to be turned on." So within five days,
yeah.
completely
absolutely
conflicting reviews.
So that which tells you absolutely nothing. Yeah, you know, the food was disgusting, and what's more, there wasn't enough of it.
Yes.
Always my favourite review. Yeah. So I don't know where it's leading is at all. But I can pledge that we will never ask people to give a star rating to the Rocking Vicar and its various outlets.
Actually, not the podcast.
Not the podcast, nor the site itself. No. No, quite so. I don't know where it's all leading. And it seems to be just a sort of interactive trend which will peak and then probably die away. But, yeah, you're right. You are asked to rate things increasingly and unnecessarily. Yes, absolutely. Now, the festive season is upon us. You might have noticed those sparkly lights out in the streets and the plethora of perfume ads on the telly, which confirm this fact.
I'm happy to acknowledge it now. Christmas, I don't acknowledge Christmas until December.
No, I think that's a fair policy, isn't it? Yeah, that's a very fair policy. So we're into December now. Now, hand on heart, have not seen the Christmas TV schedules, but I thought we'd mention it on the podcast simply because in years gone by, they have been increasingly more and more disappointing. And one of the things, other than the lashings of food and the rather lovely overpriced presents that I received, the thing I always used to look forward to in my younger years was the Christmas TV schedule, particularly the movies. I really, really did sort of champ at the bit waiting to see what sweep of movies I could catch over Christmas, because the channels would step up their game and put the best movies on at Christmas. But, you know, for at least the last 10-15 years, the TV schedule has left me sorely disappointed, and I wondered why you thought that might be, or whether indeed you thought that they had become disappointing.
The TV schedules as a whole?
Mm.
Oh, well, I suppose I think there's probably a couple of reasons for that. One is that we've lost, through the sands of time, those old performers who used to turn up every Christmas and make people of our kind of generation make sort of Christmas what it is, like Morecambe and Wise.
Well, certainly Morecambe and Wise, yeah. And Stanley Baxter only used to do Christmas, didn't he? He did one show and it would be at Christmas and it would be a lavish production, wouldn't it?
Yeah. That's right. You're absolutely right. And even other, you know, people like Dick Emery and so on would do a Christmas special. Well, actually, in the early 60s, perhaps middle 60s, when I was younger, so much younger than today, I never did anybody's help in any way. No, I remember that there was a program that used to be on, I'm pretty sure, Christmas night. Mm-hmm. It used to run for a couple of hours. And it would feature little 10-15 minute segments of your favourite BBC programmes.
Oh,
and that
okay.
was really lovely. It was,
right.
They would be Christmas editions, but little just short, little samplers, if you like, special editions all on their own, of things like Steptoe and Son, Hancock, whatever was popular at the time.
Uh-huh.
And, that was another little magical part of Christmas. But I tell you what, talking of the changes to Christmas, and again, I didn't know what was coming up when I saw Christmas TV on our menu for today, but have you heard about the controversy over this year's double issue of the Radio Times?
Well, I know the Radio Times has just recently been bought out from the BBC, hasn't it? And is this what you're going to say? Is that what, they forgot to negotiate the picture archive rights? Is this what you're going to say?
No, I wasn't. No, you're right. The Radio Times was sold to this inevitably private equity company in August. And, of course, they said, therefore, the BBC have ditched all control of it. But generally, the BBC Radio Times front cover features a cheery, burly Santa, Father Christmas, on the front cover with his laden down with his sack.
Yes.
But this year, the foolish Ben Preston, the Radio Times editor, said, this is absolute quote from him, for many years, Santa has been a cheery fixture, but somehow that didn't feel right this year. Says who? Only this Mr. Ben Preston. Wait for this. Yeah. Would Father Christmas be seen as a bloated, red-faced symbol of overindulgence?
Yes,
I would
quite,
say
quite
only
so.
To you, Mr. Preston. Get out of it.
Quite so. He's clearly a stockbroker, isn't he? Santa is just a figure of capitalism and rapacious greed and nothing more.
At a time, said Mr. Preston, when so many people are hunkering down with friends and family and turning their backs on extravagant gift-giving, we wanted something different.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, this. But by the way, this hunkering down in difficult times hasn't stopped them putting the cost of the edition up by 4.2% from last year. So instead we get this kind of red and green cover with a Christmas tree, and it looks sort of semi-Victorian, right, which is probably just what Mr. Preston wanted.
Yeah, yeah. I thought you were going to say they did put a sort of looming Grim Reaper on the
front. Yeah, I'm sure if Mr. Preston had got his way past the picture editor, yes.
With
the
bauble dangling off his scythe.
Yes, yeah. Saying, "Fear ye all who enter 2012.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so that's the Radio Times story, which reflects again on these changes. Mm. Also, I don't know, have you seen, if you haven't, I urge you to even search it out on YouTube where it exists, the appalling BBC promotional video, I suppose we'd call it, Now, Magnus, I'll just ask you a question, then I'll ask you, you can reflect on it. Yes. I just want to ask you a question before you say any more. Would you personally see a song that was an invitation from the Artful Dodger to Oliver to join his pickpocketing gang as the ideal accompaniment for the BBC Christmas promo? That's my question.
Well, yeah, I hadn't really read into it that deeply as to the
Considious
the song from Oliver. I hadn't really thought it was appropriate or not. All I thought, having seen it, was this is terrible. It is just terrible. It's a sort of Gathering of the Stars, isn't it, for anybody who hasn't seen it?
Yes.
Some of them are all wedged up onto a piano stool singing the song, and then others are in a snow scene singing this. If you haven't seen it, you will see it if you have a television. And I can't describe how awful it is. It makes you loathe every single face that appears on it. In their sort of leering and sort of superciliousness, it fills me with bile and the urgent need to defecate rather than Christmas spirit. I can't believe anybody saw the final edit and thought, "Yep, that's what we intended."
Production values are appalling. It's hopeful. Badly made. It's cheaply made.
Yeah.
It's got, you could, if you asked a stranger who hadn't seen it, who do you think is in it? You know, if they would almost inevitably say, "Well, Bruce Forsyth, Michael McIntyre, David Jason,
yeah.
Lenny Henry," and then I thought, "What's Nick Knowles doing there from DIY SOS?" Because he suddenly pops up in it, and half the people, I have to say, I'm not sure who they are.
It is nightmarish. It is really nightmarish. And if it had been for Sky One, I would have shrugged and said, "That's your satellite telly for you." But from BBC One, it is a trap. It is dire, awful, awful. Yes, and then
Here's the thing, Magnus Shaw. Here's the thing. Consider Yourself from Oliver was played at Oliver Reed's funeral.
Oh, was it? Okay, yes, because he was the original Bill Sykes, wasn't he? Yeah. Well, I say the original. He was the film, the cinema Bill Sykes, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. Well, a better place for it than this wretched BBC Christmas promo, which undoubtedly will bombard us from now until the morning of the 25th, I should imagine.
It's a terrible year for Christmas adverts as well. There's a couple that have stood out for me in their sheer awfulness. There's one for Morrison's with Freddie Flintoff.
Yes.
You would know, perhaps even you would know, he's a former England cricketer.
Yes, I didn't know, when I saw that advert, I didn't know. I know Freddie Flintoff is a cricketer, and I know the advert. I didn't know that was him in the advert.
That's Freddie Flintoff in the advert.
Yeah, I do know, I know that, yeah.
Again, a bizarre, bizarre concept, because he says his punchline is, "People will come, people will definitely come."
Yes.
And this is the sort of thing that Nelson Mandela might have said when he was being released.
Oh, well, do you know where it's from?
No, I don't.
Oh, well, okay. Well, the advert starts off with saying, "If you build it, they will come," doesn't he? It says at the beginning of the advert. And at the end, it said, "They will come, they will definitely come." This is all from the Kevin Costner movie, Field of Dreams.
Oh, I see. Oh, well, I missed the link there. Okay, well, then it kind of makes some
Field of Dreams, Kevin Costner, he has a, I won't do the whole, the whole screenplay to Field of Dreams, but he lives on a sort of prairie somewhere, and he's a farmer, and he starts having visions in his cornfield of baseball players who he idolizes. And, one of them then appears to him, at his home. I think it's James Earl Jones playing this part, and he says you've got to build a baseball pitch for the ghosts of the old great baseball players to play on. And he said, well, you know, that's a big undertaking. He's not wrong, is he? This is a big undertaking. What if it doesn't happen? And James Earl Jones says, if you build it, they will come.
It's an absolutely
appalling movie, I have to say. Absolutely dreadful, sentimental, saccharine old tosh. He does build in his wheat field, probably much to the chagrin of his wife and family, who are depending on the crops for their income, this ruddy great big baseball arena, and the ghosts of the past baseball players come and play in it.
Hard then to link that to Morrison's Christmas ad. Tootle around the store in Morrison's and pick up various
I have a mortal fear that whoever was given this brief at the advertising agency, the creative director or one of his oppos had seen Field of Dreams recently, pulled into work on a Monday morning, said, oh god, we haven't tackled this Morrison's Christmas brief. This would have been back in the summer. He said, oh, I know. I saw Field of Dreams the other afternoon. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The other one that's stuck in my mind, which I think is rather sweet until it gets to the last few seconds, which is dear Stacey Solomon from the X Factor. She's driving home for Christmas, and it's rather quite sweet there. She's driving along, the street lights reflected through the windscreen, and she's clearly getting excited as she drives home. Yeah. And she has got a splendid voice, I have to say, Stacey Solomon.
I do like Stacey Solomon.
I do too. They're lovely character.
Very honest person.
So, and she pulls up at home, and oh look, there's a little boy comes running out to meet her. It's absolutely lovely. Sure. And you think, oh, it's quite sweet. Even it looks minor lump to the throat. But then they go inside, and all these family and friends there, and they're all tucking into this Iceland food.
Yeah.
You get these little pop up banners to tell you that you can get 14 mini beef Wellingtons for £2.50 or something.
Yeah.
15 of these for that. And it sort of destroys the whole tone of the advert.
A crown of prawns, that's what you have to have at Christmas from Iceland. Crown of prawns.
But we'll make the best of Christmas no matter what.
Sure.
No matter what these obstacles placed in our way by mad Radio Times editors, crazed promo directors, and Iceland, and mini beef weather.
And Morrison's advertising agent. Quite so. The Christmas we get, we deserve, as somebody once said. But if you're in the mood for saying bar humbug to all things commercially Christmassy, you're certainly going to say bar double humbug, because it's time for the virtual iPod. And your
I'm sure we don't have time.
Your selection thereof. We have plenty of time. Plenty of time. And did you go first last week? I think you went first. There was always with this feature going to be a race between the two of us as to who would pick a track by The Clash first, and I felt if I delayed any longer you'd get me to the post. I know probably barring the Beatles, The Clash are your favourite band, and barring nobody, The Clash are my favourite band. So I felt the urgent need to pick something by The Clash. Now, so many tracks I could have picked by The Clash, and the obvious ones were there. London Calling, I Fought the Law, the Safe European Home, White Riot, etc. But none of those are my favourite Clash track. And I don't mean to be willfully obscurist here, because it's not a well-known Clash track. It just happens to be my favourite song by The Clash. It's from an EP called The Cost of Living, which I think came out in 1979, I'm going to have a guess. That is where the...
It would be a very good Get Spider.
Thank you very much, very much. And it featured I Fought the Law, which is really well known and was a staple of the Clash's live set from then on. But it was actually on the flip where there were two tracks. One was Groovy Times, which is also great, and the other, which is The Gates of the West, which is my favourite Clash song. And the reason it appeals to me so much is, for me, it is the moment the Clash went from being... albeit an extraordinarily good balls-out punk rock outfit, to a proper, mature, fully formed rock band. And I don't mean that disparagingly. They were the great rock band for me. This is the song that just sounds astonishingly accomplished for a group that had been together well, maybe only 3 years tops. It sounds very American, and there's a reason for that, because it is a song about the Clash, and particularly the guitarist Mick Jones, finding himself in the middle of Manhattan only a few short years after he had been a Dolly urchin in West London, and really, you know, started to realise some of his long-held ambitions and dreams. Has a fantastic harmonica opening, which is credited to somebody called Bob Jones. It is actually Mick. And I don't think any of us suspected any of the punks could play harmonica. It's a great piece of harp on the beginning of that. And it's lyrically, it's very clever and interesting and witty. There's lines in there like Little Richard's in the kitchen playing spoons and plates and telling the waitress he's great. Now, that is fantastic. In fact, I want that on a T-shirt sometime. What a great area. That's superb.
It's a great
area. Yeah, absolutely. And he really captures this wonder. Not everyone listening will have been to New York, but the first time you go to New York, you do walk around like a gormless idiot, just astonished that you found yourself in this, the most famous city in the world. And this song by The Clash completely captures that sense of excitement and wonder and surprise that you found yourself somehow in life visiting this extraordinary city. Other than that, it fairly bowls along. It's a real tumbler of a track. It keeps the momentum going all the way through. It's all sung by Mick, who is very distinct from Joe's singing. He always sung in a very high register, but it works beautifully on this. You know, there's keys on there. It's very nicely produced, lots of multi-tracking, and it was the moment the Clash started to sound like a really accomplished and talented rock band. And for all those reasons, it's my favourite song by my favourite band, The Clash, and it's called The Gates of the West. You'll find it on various compilations. It's certainly on Superbat Market Clash. And if you are very lucky, you may one day see the Cost of Living EP in a second-hand shop, and you can pick it up on that. It's The Gates of the West, and it's going on the virtual iPod.
Great choice. Great choice. From Camden Town Station to 44th and 8th.
Yeah, there you go. In a nutshell, that is, isn't it, really?
You've made me want to jump on a plane immediately.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Right to New York.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely great choice. Yeah, you're right. Mick was Paul and Joe was John. In terms of their writing and singing styles, Mick always was going for the melodic and the hopeful, and where, like, John Lennon in the Beatles was always angry, so Joe tended to write the angry songs.
That's, yeah, exactly.
In the Clash.
Yeah.
Seeing your choice, it reminded me of that fantastic Cost of Living EP from which it comes, as you say. And I thought, I thought that my favourite track in terms of the one I played the most also comes from this. So I just while you were talking there, I just did a quick check on Last FM, which has recorded my top played tracks over the last 7.5 years now since I joined Last FM. Right. You know, it records everything you play. Yes. Through your system. And my top played Clash tune, coming in at number 27, equal number 27 in my all-time list, is Groovy Times. Yeah. By The Clash. I've played that more than any other, which is also a great track. Yeah, from that Cost of Living EP. Yeah. But you're absolutely right. Fantastic. And if you do see it in a second-hand store, one, buy it, because it's great. Yeah. But, I mean, sure, it'd be fantastic value.
Yeah, I can remember buying it in 79 with the gatefold sleeve, and the there was a cardboard insert that just had pictures of coins and notes on it that just slid out, and I remember buying it, having it. I wish I knew where the hell it was now, because I certainly haven't got it now. Yeah,
it was the Clash at their roaring best. Oh, it has to be said.
Super.
Just absolutely their peak, and it also incredibly good value for an EP, 13 minutes.
Yeah.
Long.
Yeah, quite so. Fantastic. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Great choice, Magnus Shaw.
Thank you so much.
But come now, step inside, love, because I am going to go to another extreme, and this is as much about the production as the song. Cilla Black, Queen of Saturday Night, Easy View, Chav TV. Yeah. You may think younger listeners may not even know who she is at all, but perhaps listeners over 20, 30 maybe will remember as the chirpy front woman of, I suppose, seemingly endless sugary feel-good soap for Prozac TV shows. Yeah. The flag-waving icon of Thatcherites and professional scouser, some may say. In fact, Cilla headed to these fields of light entertainment nirvana because in the 60s, girl singers tended not to be taken very seriously, and it was thought the hits would only last for a while, and then their novelty would be gone. Yes. And as they got older, their moon would wane away, the star would fall. So, in that context, we know that Cilla was never really someone who innovated anything, even in the 60s. She wasn't interested in songwriting. She was produced, managed, of course, by Brian Epstein, and produced by George Martin at Abbey Road. So she was very much in the Beatles stable.
Yeah, and was the hat check girl at the Cavern, wasn't she?
Hat check girl at the Cavern, yeah. Indeed. And that's where she started in the Cavern, jumping up on the tiny little stage there to sing, and pressed on by her girlfriends to have a go.
Sure.
And from there on she went. But it's really important to remember that Cilla of the 60s, if you haven't listened to any of her work, all available on Spotify and YouTube, of course, it wasn't the surprise era Cilla or blind date Cilla. She has in fact, not only had, but has a fantastic vocal range, and she's got two distinctive styles, often that she showed in the same song. There was a sort of lilting, siren-like vocals that she would often use in the verse, and then she kind of rocked out with a throaty shout-out in the choruses. Now, the song that I'm talking about, she'd already had seven hit singles, but we get to 1965. She'd been used to George Martin producing her, and George Martin's way with singers was to often tended to concentrate on the orchestras, which were still in use, of course, at that time, and just left the singer to get on with it, bring their own characteristics to the vocals. So it was a huge leap of faith for Cilla when Burt Bacharach came to Abbey Road, one of the greatest songwriters of all time with his songwriting partner, Hal David. And he came to Abbey Road in 65, and he wanted to produce Cilla singing the theme song from the movie Alfie.
Ah, yeah.
And the movie, to me, is of little consequence. It's not one of my favourites at all. But if you, again, have any interest in this at all, go and search out on YouTube. There is a video, fantastic, of Cilla actually recording this song with Burt Bacharach in Abbey Road Studio 2 in 1965. Now, What is so special about this is, having said that George Martin would really just let Cilla get on with it, this girl can sing, off you go, Cilla. What Burt Bacharach did was coax the achievement of a lifetime from her. He absolutely urged her, he cajoled her, and unheard of at the time, especially when you've got a full orchestra in attendance who are being paid full musician union rate, They did 19 takes before he was satisfied that he'd got the very best vocal out of her possible.
Okay.
It's 2 minutes 40 seconds. And what Burt Bacharach told Cilla in that one session, the lesson he taught her was how to believe in a song. Don't just sing it, but live in the song as if she herself was aching with this love that she's talking about.
And like the method acting school.
Absolutely, exactly, to live within the role, exactly that. So the result is one of the greatest records of a generation. It's an absolutely volcanic mix of Cilla's raw, yet angelic, joyful voice in this particular production, and Bacharach's passion for perfection, which is, as we say, born from a genius of a musical knowledge.
Oh, yeah, quite so.
And I just wish that, really, Cilla had stayed with that association with Burt Bacharach and Hal David. I wish it had continued.
Yeah, she could have sort of run in parallel with Dusty Springfield, couldn't she?
She could, a
credible artist.
Exactly, Magnus, and even to the degree of, you know, you sort of Dionne Warwick, that kind of figure.
Indeed.
Well,
yeah.
NRS, whatever. You know, she had some great performances still ahead. Surround Yourself with Sorrow, If I Thought You'd Ever Change Your Mind, Something's Going to Tell Me Something's Going to Happen Tonight. But she never really captured that performance level again.
No.
And those production values. So that's my choice for this week, is the absolutely splendid 2 minutes 40 seconds of Burt Bacharach producing Cilla Black singing Alfie.
Fantastic, good choice. And I actually are quite taken with the movie as well. I've seen that a few times, and I think that's overlooked. It's not the sort of throwaway comedy that it's often perceived to be. I quite like the film too. Okay, well, thanks very much for that. That shall go on the virtual iPlayer. The virtual iPod would be a better title for it, being as it's the correct one. And we'll put that up we'll put that up in the next few hours. And that brings us to a close. Thanks very much for your time and company and information and erudition on this particular
edition. It's a joy and a pleasure. Thank you.
Particular edition of the Parish Council. Thanks, Terence. Goodbye. Please do visit the website as well if you're listening to this before you've done that. 3 articles on there for you, plus lots of the usual old nonsense as well. All your favourite features. And we shall be back with more Parish Council in 7 days. See you then. Bye bye.
Believe in love.